I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Ned Campy. He is General Director of Opera Memphis, and he is Director of The Last Savage, which opens this Saturday, July 23rd, at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's talk about this opera. We talked about it a couple of months ago with Desiree Mays, but give us just a quick plot synopsis of what this opera is about.
Sure. The story is basically about Kitty Scattergood, who is the daughter of the renowned Chicago millionaire Aloysius Scattergood. She is completing her PhD in anthropology at Vassar, and her father desperately wants her to get married to the son of the Maharaja of Rajputana. The story takes place in the 60s, and Scattergood is very worried that, he wants to make sure that his daughter is taken care of, so he's trying to get her into this arranged marriage with this very rich prince of Rajputana. But she refuses to get married until she completes her PhD in anthropology, and to do that, she needs a thesis, and her thesis is to find the last savage man in India. She believes there's a race of prehistoric cavemen still alive. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that there is no such thing as a race of prehistoric cavemen, and the Maharani of Rajputana realizes that if they ever want their kids to get married, they're going to have to invent a savage. So they get the boyfriend of one of the palace servants to dress up and pretend to be sort of a wild man, and they allow her to capture him, and she brings him back to Chicago to tame him and civilize him. And at the end of Act Two, there's this big party where he's presented to society, and he meets all the representatives of art and culture and politics of civilization, and he realized if this is what civilization is like, I'd much rather be a savage. And so Act Three is him going back to the jungle to become a savage and everyone else looking for him, because by this point, of course, Kitty has fallen deeply in love with him. And that is essentially the story.
And it is very funny, and this is a work from the early 1960s. It reminds me kind of that mid to late 60s political and social satire that mm-hmm. you see a lot in films. It's a little earlier than that, and it really makes fun of society and colonialism in a big way.
Absolutely. You know, one of the big inspirations for the piece, touchstones for me, was the Doris Day Rock Hudson movie Lover Come Back. That is a movie that from basically the same period that deals with a lot of the same themes about the role of marriage, the role of women, the role of men. What does love mean? Are love and marriage the same thing? You know, and it was written at a time when all of these things were changing, and the idea of a woman having a job and a career outside of the family, or does she have to give that up? Can she keep that? All of these things were being dealt with in comedy in a much more blunt way, in a much more interesting way than they were being dealt with in drama. You know, if you're laughing at something, you can actually present ideas that are much more radical and much more interesting than you can in a drama where people take it very seriously.
It's not your typical opera in the sense, I mean, there are comic operas, but it's pretty over the top in a lot of ways, and nobody dies of consumption. It's completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, you know, here you are as the director. You've been thinking about this for several years because you've known you're going to do it for mm-hmm. several years. How do you start conceiving of a production like this? I mean, there's a lot of other people involved in the production, but how do you start thinking about the tone that you want to set for something which is just so I think satirical, unrealistic, funny, and goofy, and kind of a period piece.
Sure. I like all of those descriptive words. We actually looked at, talking about Lover Come Back, there was a movie a few years ago called Down with Love that was a sort of a modern-day gloss on those Doris Day Rock Hudson comedies. And it basically took the essential beats and look and feel of those movies and heightened it and looked at it a little bit with a wink and a nod. The same way that when we watch a show like Mad Men today, while that's a drama, not a comedy, we look at pregnant women smoking and drinking martinis, and we're able to, we can laugh at that or be horrified by that as we desire. But you look at a movie like that, that sort of looks back at the period, heightens it a little bit, just makes it a little brighter, a little more pastel colored than maybe it actually was at the time. And we tried to do the same thing. You know, you want to look back at the period, you want to present it in some ways as it was, and actually a lot of the costumes that we have in the party scene in the 60s are actual period costumes. This was actually how people dressed. And we just, as they say, we turn it up to 11. You know, you just make it a little more absurd, a little goofier. And with the scenes that are set in India, now that is in a mythical, what we've called Hollywood India. You know, it wasn't supposed to take place in a kind of realistic India. It was a fantasy of what India would be, a fantasy of wealth and elephants and you know, rajas and that sort of thing. So we tried to be very honest with that and present a kind of fairy tale India for the beginning. And you just start looking at things, looking at research, and you, again, you just dial it up a little bit so that it stands out and it pops.
It is very funny, the party scene to which you were referring. I went to the dress rehearsal, and it was also youth night the other night, which was great fun. But you see the characters of kind of beatniks and poets and musicians doing weird, over-serious German poetry and music and things like that. And it is hilarious. And I was sort of thinking, it's as funny now as it must have been in 1963, but almost in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I actually think it might be funnier. You know, it's very hard to satirize your own time. It's a little too close. And I think we're able to look back at 50 years later at the themes or the threads of music or, you know, what poetry was like. We're able to laugh at it in a very different way, you're right. But I think in a freer way, it's not quite as pungent as it might have been when it was initially written. And, you know, Menotti, he had a bone to pick with, especially with the musical establishment at the time, because he had the audacity to write music that was beautiful, that people enjoyed. Instead of writing things that were thorny and difficult and academic, he wrote music that was actually fun to listen to, that moved people. And because of that, he was critically reviled for a long period of time. And it's only now, you know, right around the time of his 100th birthday, that people are looking back at some pieces like this and saying, this is beautiful music. This is funny. This is, you know, the equal of any Donizetti opera. Why aren't we doing this anymore? So when he was satirizing, especially the musical establishment, it was very, very pointed. And I think at the time, maybe it raised some hackles that it no longer raises today. So we're able to be very free with it.
Now, I take it this is not a very often performed opera.
That is correct.
Why is that?
You know, in part just because of the scale of it. There are 18 principal roles. There are 18 people who have individual lines. And part of it is just today to hire that number of singers would be very prohibitive cost-wise. The beauty of doing it here at Santa Fe is you get the luxury of casting all these brilliant young artists who are going to be the great artists of tomorrow. You get to cast them in these roles where they might only have three or four lines, but you're getting, it's what we call luxury casting. You're getting people who are 2 or 3 years are going to be singing Rodolfo and Mimi all over the world, and you get them to sing these little, you know, compromario roles. So
you're talking about the apprentices.
I'm talking about the apprentices, exactly. Yeah. So I think that is a large part of it. I think as well, you know, when you do a new piece at most opera companies in the States, or you do an English piece, you maybe do one a season or one every other season, something like that. There, a company like Santa Fe that has sort of the guts and the integrity to do a piece like this, there aren't that many of us, you know.
Right.
And I'm speaking now as somebody who runs a regional opera. I understand the challenges of doing a piece that doesn't have the name recognition of a Bohème or a Carmen, and it means that you need to put a lot of weight behind it. You need to say that, yes, you may not have heard of this opera, but believe me, it's fantastic, it's worth your time, it's worth your money. And, you know, Santa Fe can do that because they have such a long history of excellence. They can say anything we're going to put on this stage is going to be worth your time. And every company has that.
And it's one of five.
It's one of five, yeah.
And so somebody might be coming into town, or somebody might be seeing two or three over the course of a summer, or all five of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, the performance that I went to, it opens on Saturday night, so the opening hasn't happened yet, but I went to this youth night, dress rehearsal / youth night, and that is such an interesting audience for, I would think, for you as the director, because here are all these people coming from the schools, from the pueblos, from all over the place.
My wife said there was a 12-year-old girl in the bathroom who had a very serious discussion with her mother about how she preferred this to Madame Butterfly because it was funnier. So I think that should be her tagline, more laughs than Madame Butterfly. That's I don't know how many tickets that would sell, but you know, what's wonderful about a youth night, about teenagers or young folks, is there's no politeness to them. If they laugh, they mean it. If they don't laugh, they mean it. It's either they don't get it or they just don't find it funny. So there is a brutality to their impressions of the piece that is very, very useful, especially when you have time to go back and say, okay, that we didn't get quite the kind of laugh we needed there, so why, you know, okay, so we need to tweak this title, or we need to have you standing further forward, or maybe we just need to do something different. And if they do laugh, that's wonderful, and it sort of reinforces what is funny, and you know, I think it was great for the performers to hear some feedback, to, you know, to get that. And, you know, laughter's the best drug of all. I mean, you can sort of see them feeding on it and getting it and thriving on it. So it was very useful in that sense.
We're talking to Ned Canty, director of The Last Savage, which is opening at the Santa Fe Opera this Saturday, the 23rd of July. It's one of those operas, and we've talked about this a great deal with Desiree, but there was a period in history where it was more about the singing than the acting. Mm-hmm. This is so much, to my eye anyway, mm-hmm. about the acting. I mean, mm-hmm. the singing, it's almost like you take it for granted. You get the great singers anyway. But the people who were cast in the lead roles, particularly Kitty Scattergood mm-hmm. and Abdul and Kitty's father, they were so perfect and so funny and so so great at that satire. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how. I mean, you're the director. You bring this out of them. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I mean, do you say, think Doris Day?
Mm-hmm. We actually did a lot of that. I gave them a list of movies that I thought they should watch that would get to the spirit and the style. And it is, you know, there's definitely a style to this sort of comedy. There's a craft to it. To give one example, with Kevin Burdett, who plays Mr. Scattergood, there are a couple of spit takes in the opera. If for folks who don't know what a spit take is, it's, you know, Danny Thomas was sort of the best practitioner of it, is you're drinking and someone says something shocking and you... and you spurt, you know, water
you
or whiskey
whatever, all over the stage.
Whatever it is. So we decided that we wanted to try these. There are a number of shocking moments, and the idea of the spit take is very, it's very classic comedy. It was something that really reached its peak in the 60s. So we decided we wanted to try some of these, and Kevin went home on his day off, and he went on YouTube, and he got 10 or 12 different examples of Estelle Getty and Danny Thomas and Gene Wilder and all these different people doing it, and we looked at them, and we said, okay, this is really the one that we want to try. So it's a very craft-based approach. It's really about looking at how the comedy stacks up. And then from my perspective as the director, it's all about walking in having an idea for every moment in the piece, having a sense of this might be funny, we should try this, but then also having the humility and the openness to be inspired by the performers themselves. So many of the funniest things that are on stage are things that happened in rehearsal, and your job as the director is not to say, do this, that's going to be funny, but to encourage everyone to feel like they can experiment or try things and either be funny or not be funny and fail, and that even if they fail, that's okay, try something different, we'll find the right thing. So I think it really comes out of that, and your job as the director is to edit and make sure that everybody is in the same world and has the same style and is sort of playing with the same type of comedy.
The costumes and scenery was absolutely brilliant. The brilliant Alan Moyer involved in that. How do you work together? Have you been working with him for years? Is he pretty much on his own?
No, we've been working on this for about 2 years, and it is a very long process. I think that it's with a piece like this, where the style is so important and it needs to have a particular tone, having someone like Alan, who A, is a genius, but B, is doing both costumes and sets, you really get a very unified feel, and I'm glad that came across last night. We've been working for about 2 years, and the process just starts with sort of talking about the piece. We talked about these films that were important to me. I would do things like email him a picture of a hat that Doris Day wore in one of these movies and say, you know, it's kind of like that. You know, this is the spirit. This is the feel that it should have. And he, like all designers, has books and books and books of wonderful research. So we looked not only at pictures of colonial India, but we also looked at pictures of Hollywood and Bollywood and, you know, different styles of architecture or clothing that seem to capture something about grandeur and something about the fun and spirit of the piece. So we looked at many, many pictures and then started winnowing it down, and we would, maybe every 2 months or so, we would get together or we would have a phone call. And in fact, a lot of the most important decisions were made when I was on a phone call we had while I was taking a train from New York to Trenton, New Jersey, and we just talked the whole time about sort of the how to break down the three acts and how to make things work technically when you have so many different settings. You know, the piece was written for the Met, and so it was written for, you know, almost unlimited money in the 60s, you know, when they could do almost anything. And so what we had to do was find ways to create that same grandeur and that same scale. You know, there's a scene where they build a wall. And when you're writing a show for the Met, you could say, great, we'll have 12 people come on and they'll build a wall on stage. And so that's what we needed to live up to, is this this level of grandeur and spectacle that Menotti had set in the original production.
And using that as an example, it was done in such a beautiful, perfect, minimal way. There are these, I guess, white cardboard boxes that get stacked up, and they sort of pretend to mortar them, and they take them down a few minutes later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. And it, you know, it's just an example of the fact that of what unlimited wealth means. You know, the Maharaja, this idea, you know, another big theme in it is, do you need money to be happy? And what's interesting is that, as it turns out, some of the characters do need money to be happy, but they are treated quite gently. And the ones who don't, you know, sort of end up together and end up happy, and the ones who do end up together and end up happy. You know, it's a very, you're right, there, no one dies of consumption in this opera. It's very much a wedding kind of marriage rather than a death kind, or a wedding kind of opera rather than a death
right.
kind of opera.
Yeah, and at the end, just about everybody's happy.
Just about.
As I was watching it, I thought, there are probably some what you might call politically correct people who would object to what they're watching right now. Has anybody reacted like, oh my God, this is so, I don't know, just politically incorrect,
right.
or colonialist or something like that?
Not yet. You know, I think the thing about the piece is that it is an equal opportunity teaser. You know, everybody comes in for a few jabs and a few pokes. There are definitely things that were funny in those days that are not as funny these days for one reason or another. The Maharani character, for instance, is very, very heavy, and so very fat. I'll go ahead and say fat. And so there's a lot in the piece where people are making fun of her for being so large, and so you have to think, well, how do we address that? You know, and A, you know, you do it by sort of making her comically unbelievably large, but what's interesting even at the time is the character is actually sort of the smartest person on stage, and also the most sensuous person on stage is this one that everybody makes fun of. So you try to find that balance and make sure that everybody knows that that it's all in good fun. You know, it's about teasing rather than mocking. There's nothing mean-spirited in this piece at all, which is part of what makes it so enjoyable to work on.
One thing that I thought was funny and interesting about it is that you are most definitely using the 60s style, the early 60s costumes and all of that, but you also just bring in whatever you want whenever you want. So there's cell phones in it at one little moment, and there's this moment where the character of the father makes little Nixon peace signs, which is, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah.
And you just basically have the ability to be free with cultural references.
Yeah. You know, I think that with some of it, the cell phone moment, actually, at the very end, we sort of have a leap forward in time.
Right.
And so there is hopefully a sense that we've moved from the past to the modern day just at the very end, as a reminder of the fact that, you know, that while this may be politically incorrect, it is satire, and we are sort of looking back at this time where it all made sense. So, and you know, but with the other stuff, comedy by necessity needs to be a little anarchic and a little free, and, you know, if somebody in the audience is thinking, well, you know, that wouldn't have happened, that particular dress wouldn't have been in fashion until 1965, and this is set in 1963, then I've really not done my job very well.
Right,
because
right.
hopefully this is a piece that its only goal is to delight and entertain, to make people feel good about themselves and to make people feel good about the world, that maybe at the end of the day there can be happy endings, that people can figure things out, and that the world doesn't need to be dark and aggressive, and, you know, people don't need to constantly be fighting each other about anything, that maybe sometimes people can solve their differences and get married and find the person they're meant to be with and live happily ever after. And, you know, from my perspective as a director, thank goodness that we have stories like that still, because, you know, today more than ever, sometimes you just need to go and spend a couple of hours in the theater being reminded that human beings are human beings and always have been and always will be, and that everything's going to be okay. Trust me, it's all going to be okay.
Although I have to say that if you look at those characters and in real life try to extrapolate what people would have been like 10, 20 years later, I see divorce looming.
Potentially.
Ned Canty is General Director of Opera Memphis, Director of The Last Savage, which opens at the Santa Fe Opera this Saturday, the 23rd of July. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.